we just have to be very careful about politicizing the criminal justice system, I think. And I think right now we live in a very polarized country. We have extremes on either side. I think it's time that we all kind of get into the middle and start having conversations about what's best in the criminal justice system. Both ends of the spectrum have points of view that I think are important and we need to listen. But bringing those positions to a place where they can actually communicate and dialogue, you know, that's what's important. And then trying to figure out how everyone can be satisfied, if you will, in some way by making sure that the system is working the way that it should work.
How does one overcome a duly discriminated disposition as an African-American woman in a male-dominated industry? A poor woman growing up with a large family who got a law degree, became a successful prosecutor, yet experienced discrimination from her own peers for being on the wrong side of the law. What would then inspire that same woman to jump into the fire pit that is politics? Let's find out in the next TCast with Tiffany Burks. I'd like to learn a little bit about your upbringing and what led you to into law enforcement and lawyering.
So I love talking about my upbringing because it's something that I'm very proud of in terms of my parents. My parents were born in rural America. My mom's from Louisiana. Father's from Alabama, born in 1926. My mother was born in 1940. Shotgun houses, lots of kids, not a lot of money, and just a really strong work ethic they both had. And so my father was a World War II veteran. He went at the age of 15.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know. So he's a veteran of underage military service. That's what they call him.
Who'd have thought?
And when he came out, kind of took on the role of the patriarch because his father died when he was in Germany, and took care of his family, sisters, his mom, went to high school, went to college at Tuskegee, met my mother when she graduated high school and she was going to vocational school to be a nurse. And the two of them had six kids. I was number five. I know. And, you know, that's, you know, how they raised me with a really strong work ethic.
And yeah, it's a working class family coming up. But it, you said it was a poor neighborhood in general?
In general, you know, I don't, my parents probably didn't make more than $15 an hour together combined the whole time I was raised. So with six children and a house and, you know.
They both had jobs.
Both had jobs. Well, for a while, my father had like three jobs so that my mother could stay home. And then when they started to have more kids, my dad was like, you need to work.
So, this should have been planned out ahead of time.
So, so then, yeah, both my parents began working, and just, you know, doing what they could to enforce strong work ethic, faith, church every Sunday, didn't miss it. Sang in the choir, campfire girl, you know, all of that. Just
love it.
Trying to keep us involved because they didn't want the neighborhood to get us.
Okay.
So they kept us involved.
So it wasn't a neighborhood where, I mean, I think in general, people treat their kids as if, look, if you have too much time on your hands, you're going to find some shenanigans to get into, right?
Right.
But when you're in a neighborhood that has violent crime and drugs and different things, then it could be a whole lot worse. Is that is that more of the neighborhood profile you're talking about?
Probably not that extreme, but certainly there was a criminal element in our neighborhood. And of course, parents try to shield you as much as they can from it. And so my parents did that by keeping us in church and keeping us involved in things at school and Just trying to give us as many outlets.
Staying busy. Yeah.
Idle hands are the devil's workshop, right? So just keeping us busy, keeping us focused on school and trying to keep us a firm spiritual foundation through church. And I remember the neighbor across the street told my dad once that your kids won't make it. You've got too many of them and y'all don't make enough. So I remember that.
Okay. So as a launch point then, what got into you that made you think at some point, hey, I can not only be successful and pull my bootstraps up and make my own way, but become a lawyer and do something even more remarkable than just being a person that can support themselves.
Right. Honestly, I didn't have any choice. You know, you're raised in a home with a very strict disciplinarian. There were a lot of expectations. My mom was very nurturing, so it was a great balance. But we didn't know anything else other than to go to school and work hard, and because that was constantly taught. So that plus having parents who were very supportive in terms of you can do anything you set your mind to. Like my father would say that all the time.
Okay.
You're a Hamilton. Don't forget it. You can do whatever you want to do.
Okay.
So that foundation plus the support, you know, made all the difference. All of us graduated from high school. All of us have college degrees. Some of us have postgraduate degrees.
That's impressive.
But it's my parents. It's mm-hmm. what I, you know, we are a product of our environment. And my environment was, I probably didn't see as much as other people saw because my parents just worked really hard to keep us from it.
And so what made you lean in the law enforcement and lawyering direction? So
I remember this vividly. I was about 12, sitting in the den, watching a 60 Minutes episode with my dad. I'm mm-hmm. a daddy's girl. Mm-hmm. And there was an episode about a man who had been falsely accused of a crime and had been incarcerated. And it was determined later that he didn't do it. And I remember asking my dad, you know, how does something like this happen? And his words stuck with me. He said, if you want to change a system, you got to be a part of it. Hmm. And I was 12. I didn't think much of it at the time, but
it stayed.
But it stuck.
Yeah.
And my mom will probably tell you that I was always kind of argumentative and inquisitive.
No.
Very inquisitive, asked a lot of questions. You know, you have parents that say, because I say so, that was never sufficient. You know, why, mom? Because I said so. No. But why? And I think I just had leanings toward justice and the right thing and trying to make life better for people in general.
Interesting.
And so, and, you know, again, my parents, they were both, my father, very giving, you know, sacrificed a lot going to war at 15.
Can't even imagine.
No. 16 carrying a gun in Germany. Like, can't even imagine.
I mean, even 18, it's kind of right. unimaginable, really. Right. That kind of war time. No.
And my mom, nurse, she went to school to be an LVN and she was in nursing and just both very humble, giving spirits. And so they taught that to us, you know, to try to give back. And so I think all of that together and all of that just questioning lots of things and wanting to understand and mm-hmm. it just seemed like the right place to go.
Kind of a noble launch point, I would say.
A noble launch sure. point, yeah.
So was that, what is one of the more impactful lessons that you learned? It sounds like you've already described several, but what is maybe the most important thing that you learned during that adolescent period that has allowed you to be successful here?
My dad used to always say, just keep living. So just keep living. You know, life is going to bring you in different directions, different roadblocks, different obstacles, different successes, different people, different platforms. Just keep living.
Okay.
And use whatever is given to you to do the best you can for others. Just keep living.
That's excellent. Mm-hmm. And a simplified way to look at things too, not to get too high, not
That's
to get
right.
too low,
mm-hmm.
right? So one of the things that I wanted to jump into, and we like to kind of discuss some of these things, apolitically, but just conceptually, is with the racial disparity in the prisons and things that go on, and the experience that you have as a prosecutor, seeing things come in and out of the office, and your discernment and the things that you've seen, and knowing that it still kind of goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas as to what might help us to continue to turn the corner? Because, I mean, you're talking about seeing something on 60 Minutes when you were 12.
Right.
And to this day, we're still seeing a lot of the same thing, right?
Yeah. I think the first thing is just acknowledging that it exists. You know, there are some people that don't believe that there is disparity in our police contact. There's disparity in our sentencing. There's disparity in who is paroled and who isn't. Like, people don't think that that's actually a thing. But I think if we all start or begin to acknowledge that this disparity does in fact exist, then we can start looking at ways to make changes.
You know? I would agree with that too. And it's part of what we're trying to do is to try to enlighten people who think it doesn't go on these days. It's something of a passé time. You know, in the 60s, we know there was lots of racism and the police departments and everything else. And it's a different approach now. And I think a lot of it's ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some ways that we can actually, other than these types of conversations, maybe where we can pull some people in that are willing to listen and try to understand, what are some other ways that we can actually get people to recognize that it exists? Because a lot of it is just not really knowing as much as being fervently against the idea that it exists.
So I think we can start really with education, you know, just educating ourselves. And when I say ourselves, I mean those of us who have either worked or are currently working in the criminal justice system. Let's have a dialogue about it. I mean, African Americans make up, 13% of the population, mm-hmm. but 40% of our prison population.
Right.
I mean.
But that same stat gets flipped
twisted
on its head.
Right.
Because they're like, well, this just supports Joe's theory that African Americans commit more crimes.
Right.
And so a lot of times that gets turned on its head too, because the disposition that they came from, you know, and they're talking about past generations don't apply. I mean, all these things apply, obviously. So it is complicated. So I like that. The dialogue has got to be important. What about schools? Any idea on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, what we should and should not teach our kids in school. Let's try just teaching history.
Actual history.
Actual history.
Yeah.
And let's try teaching a little bit of honesty
mm-hmm.
about our cultures, the history of our country. I mean, education is a powerful tool, and history is a powerful tool if people want to learn about it. You know, every February, I do, and most people who follow me on Facebook, they know I do a Black History moment every day.
Mm.
And it's not just for me to learn more about a part of history that is part of American history. It's so that I can not only learn, but maybe share something with someone else who didn't know something, in the hopes that we begin to bridge the divide
mm-hmm.
that we see that has become so prevalent in our country right now. I mean, we're so polarized and fractions and
yeah,
it's a... But to kind of answer your question, I think we have to acknowledge it. We have to educate ourselves about it. And then I think we have to do something. And maybe the way to do something is to, you know, let's look at implicit biases. Let's train on that. We all have them. Mm-hmm. Right. So why not have some training with police officers or with prosecutors or, you know, parole officers or, you know, whomever in the criminal justice profession, because we all have them. We all know that they exist, or I shouldn't say we all know that they exist. They exist. Whether right. we know they exist or not is right. Is another question. But, you know, we could really learn from one another if we discuss the biases that we all have.
Mm-hmm. So transitioning from that into where you are, you're in a disposition of discrimination and twofold because mm-hmm. you're an African-American woman. Mm-hmm. What kind of hurdles, if any, do you feel like you've had to navigate? Because I mean, obviously you're a successful professional and you've done more than a lot of people would have predicted that you could mm-hmm. going all the way back to your neighbor. Right. Mm-hmm. So not that there is anything wrong with having to jump hurdles or not having to jump hurdles, but sometimes it's interesting to learn what hurdles there are that people don't, again, realize, especially, you know, males in a male-dominated industry. Sometimes it's difficult for males to see where those discriminatory mm-hmm. Actions take place. What types of things have you experienced coming up?
So I have to work harder. I mean, that's just the way it is. I don't have the luxury sometimes of not working hard. It's like constantly having to prove myself to myself and to the people that are around me. So I remember when I first started as a prosecutor, I would go to my office, close the door, and work. And people would come by and knock and say, "Hey, you want to go to lunch?" And I say, "You know, no, I need to work." And so I realized that I sometimes have to work harder in order for people to see my value and to see my worth.
Even in your own mind.
Even in my own mind sometimes.
Yeah, you were saying that you mm-hmm. for to prove to yourself, huh? Mm-hmm. And is that something that, I mean, obviously that's something that's ingrained, but is also a bias that has been put inside your mind that shouldn't be, but I mean, to your advantage in some ways and to your disadvantage in so many others.
Right. So imagine walking into a store and someone follows you around through the store.
Yeah.
For what reason? Mm-hmm. Right. And those kind of things stick with you because you begin to question your own worth sometimes when that happens. It happens. I can recall as a lawyer going into stores and feeling that I was being followed or that I couldn't be trusted. And so again, those biases are real. People have them. I don't blame people for them. It just is what it is. People have them. Let's acknowledge that we have them.
Right.
Let's talk about it. And let me and, you know, other people show that that's not who we are.
That's an interesting take. And from a professional standpoint, was there anything, obviously I'm not looking for names or to get people in trouble.
I'll give you names. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, from the point at which you were hired out of college and everything else, did you feel like there were differences and biases and things that you had to overcome, or was it just kind of a naivety that any college grad would have and just trying to take the first step and hit the road?
You know, sure. I mean, I have so many examples I could give you, Tegan. I remember my first year at the University of Texas, maybe in the first 3 months was rush week. And I remember a fraternity having a car on the campus that was kind of beat up. And on the side of it, it said, "Go home, coon." This is 1989. Hmm. So, yeah, you got to work. I mean, you just feel like you have to work harder. You try to ignore what's going on externally. You try not to make that a part of who you are. Sometimes it's harder than others, other times. Some situations are harder to put in the back of your mind than others. But you try really hard not to allow the external things going on around you dictate how you process things and who you are as a person.
That seems very difficult, especially back then.
It can be, but you got to do it. I mean, you got to do it.
Do you get any of the flack that law enforcement gets in general? Are you feeling some of that pushback as well from, I mean, from friends or anybody bringing politics into the home? Or again, no names necessarily, but I mean, yeah. There's a great divide, it seems like, right now. I don't think the problems are really any worse, but perceptually, they certainly are a lot worse. I think a lot of things are being discovered that have been going on, but yes, are you a part of that?
Sort of. So I think it's kind of taboo for, because you already discussed this, I'm a double minority, if you will. I'm African-American mm-hmm. and a female. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of taboo for, or has been taboo for me to be a prosecutor. You know, many people think I should be a defense attorney. I'm on the wrong side of justice, right?
Good point.
And what people don't really understand, or what I try to explain to people, is you need diversity on both sides of the aisle. And when I say diversity, I don't mean just in terms of ethnicity. I'm talking gender. I'm talking ethnicity and thought, ethnicity and, you know, what region of the country. You know, Westerners don't think the same as Southerners and Midwesterners, right? Mm-hmm. But you need diversity in what we do, because we bring different perspectives, unique perspectives. And that is what I think the criminal justice system needs a lot of. If everyone is a cookie cutter model of themselves, then everything is going to be exactly the same all the time. Right. We don't want that.
Yeah. Then the system remains, because there's a problem in the system.
That's right.
You have to infiltrate the system with diversity and different ways of thinking about things.
That's right.
I like that.
So it's really important to bring, you know, a diverse thought into what we do. And, you know, I try to encourage people who are minorities in some way, whatever that is, to come to a DA's office so that you can have that diversity in thought and people can have dialogue and discussions about, you know, we do it all the time. A case comes across your desk and you end up going to someone saying, hey, what do you think about this? And if you have a diversity in thought, people bring in a different perspective, you can maybe see something that you may not have seen because of, you know, my environment.
Right.
There's something that I might miss, your environment.
Is there any of the processes that you usually deal with on a day-to-day basis that you would change if you had the choice to do so, that kind of boxes in a particular way that business is done in a prosecutorial office? Not necessarily yours, but whether it would be a standard practice kind of across the board or in your office alone?
Process, I don't know if process is the word I'd use. I'd certainly, you know, in a position of leadership, I think it's important for the leadership to define what the mood is, what the tenor is, what the edict is for the office. And so to say process, I'm not sure, but as a leader, I would say, you know, doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Okay.
That's all the time.
And that comes through leadership.
I mean, you have to be very clear to the people that this is what your expectations are. This is what you want, you know, to happen.
Yeah.
And that comes from above. That comes from the leadership making sure that he or she makes sure that people understand what the expectation is and what they want. And whenever I would train people in the DA's office, that's what I would train them. Do the right thing for the right reasons. And if you're making a decision and you don't really know why you're making it, it's probably not the right reason. You haven't thought it through.
Interesting.
So every case is different. Every individual is different. Every defendant is different. Every victim is different. You know, police officers are all different. So you really have to individualize your treatment for that case. And that's really important.
Yeah, it's tough to do in mass, too, I'm
sure.
It is
tough, yeah. But you it's one case at a time.
So you're painting a picture that I'm starting to understand as I lead to this other question, but with all the chaos and political drama and excitability around law enforcement and things like that, what inspires you to jump into a pool of lava at this point and go into a political race for Tarrant County DA? Yeah. What has actually inspired that? Or I may be able to guess following a lot of the things you've just explained, but
yeah, you just answered my question, right? The political lava. There's just too much of it in our criminal justice system. Too much politicizing, too much partisanship, decisions being made for the wrong reasons. And that's what prompted me to jump in.
What are some things, when you say things that are decisions made for the wrong reasons, what are some examples of some things like that you might be talking about?
Well, I mean, if we are doing the right thing, if we're trying to see that justice is being done, that decision should be based on the information that we have in front of us, the law that applies to it, and conversations and communications that we're having with the victims of crime. Even when we talk to defense attorneys who will come up and say, hey, you may not know this about my client, but you know, I'm going to put this information out there for you to know. We need to be making decisions based on those reasons, right? Not because, you know, we want to prosecute cases because we feel like it'll help us in our own political aspirations, or it's what our base wants us to do, or there is public outrage about a certain thing. We have to be very careful about, I think, about making decisions based on that. Not to say that that can't influence decisions in some way when you speak to the people involved in it, but we just have to be very careful about politicizing the criminal justice system, I think. And I think right now we live in a very polarized country. We have extremes on either side. I think it's time that we all kind of get into the middle and start having conversations about what's best in the criminal justice system. So,
amen to that.
So that's one of the big reasons that I jumped in the race.
That's fantastic. And we need good leadership and the focal point on that middle. I think there's a lot more of us in the middle that aren't raising flags and making a stink on the news. There's a lot of us in that middle, even on opposing sides, but that are civil enough to have a conversation about what needs to happen. So I really like that.
And you can get things done. I mean, both ends of the spectrum have points of view that I think are important and we need to listen. But bringing those positions to a place where they can actually communicate and dialogue, you know, that's what's important. And then trying to figure out how everyone can be satisfied, if you will, in some way by making sure that the system is working the way that it should work. So that's, I know it's kind of utopian, but.
It doesn't seem utopian to me because that's been kind of my plight too. I just know there's more of us, but when you're dealing with a world full of extremists that are getting the majority of the spotlight and the platforms to speak, it seems moot. But really, there are so many of us here in the middle that are willing to listen to one another. And that's really, I mean, you kind of have to dismiss extremists because there's not really talking to an extremist anyway. You're not going to talk them back even to the middle most of the time.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you can't do that, but I know that you should at least try that.
That would be worth it.
Be worth it.
Interesting. Well, that would be amazing if we could do that. I will say that for sure.
But we should try it as opposed to saying it can't be done.
All right. I like that. And tell me a little bit about, so is this your first
campaign ever?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about this experience, because it's unenviable, it seems, from my perspective, but how has it been for you?
It has been very interesting. I have learned a lot about myself in this process. I realize that I'm stronger than I thought I was. I've also found that running for an office, that politics is just that, politics. Mm-hmm. And that there are times that people will put things out there in the hopes that people will latch on to it and equate that to negatively to a candidate.
Maybe just like floating something that's an untruth of some sort, just kind of floating it out there and seeing
or putting a spin on things in a way that it's not meant to or intended. Mm. I get it. It's politics. I don't like it because, I prefer and I will run a clean campaign. I'm not going to disparage other people. I'm going to talk about my experience and my qualifications. And the way that I see it is if I'm not being attacked, then I'm not doing something right. I expect for people to say, she's qualified, she's experienced, she could be a threat. What can I do to
hedge
that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the fact that that's happening means I'm doing something right.
That makes sense. And I like, one of my questions was also going to be about typical political approaches, which seem to be half about disparaging the other side and half about talking about the ABCs of somebody's viewpoints. Mm-hmm. But what essentially is your pitch and your platform essentially in terms of going forward then?
So my platform is to rebuild public service, restore public trust. A lot of that has to do with what we just discussed, mm-hmm. that I feel like our communities don't trust the criminal justice system. They don't think that we are fair. They don't think that we're equitable in the system. We're not trying to do the right thing. We don't care about people as human beings. And I have, over the course of being a prosecutor for the last, over 20 years, I pride myself on being the kind of prosecutor who has done just that, right? Dismissing murder cases because we shouldn't be prosecuting that case. Or, the 17-year-old that's never been in trouble before may not need to go to jail, mm-hmm. Go give me a clean urine analysis and show me that you're not doing drugs and I'll dismiss your case. And so we need to do things in the criminal justice system to rebuild the public service aspect of what we do. It's not about getting convictions. It's not about, sending people to prison. We know there are issues with mass incarceration. So let's try to find other avenues to push people through so that they can get the help that they need whenever we can give it. But also hold people accountable for, their conduct.
Right. Which is something I noticed in you too, which is, these ideas are fantastic and understanding but it's not all softballs either.
No,
I've seen you draw lines in the sand and say, this isn't going to happen and we're going to lay the hammer here too, right?
Absolutely. Accountability is key. And that's part of the criminal justice system, holding people accountable for their conduct.
Right.
But I think generally speaking, the public feels like that's all we do is right. just hammer, 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 hammer.
Yeah.
And we need to try to find ways to restored the trust in our criminal justice system, in our community. And one of the ways we do that, I think, is, and one of the things that I've been a very vocal about since I started this campaign, is trying to collaborate with different civic organizations, churches, law enforcement, you know, to build a, what I like to call a safety net, right? And there are some that we're going to be able to catch and put them in services or send them in places where they can get help. And then there are others that, you know, like we talk about, you know, they're going to have some accountability that's stronger than just a probation or mental health treatment or drug treatment.
But they would perhaps have somewhere to go upon release too, which is another
reentry,
whole
is
another problem. Yeah,
that's a whole another issue. We could talk, but that's a whole
separate podcast.
Separate podcast, right?
Well, I'm interested. Maybe we'll do another one.
Well, we can do another one. But yeah, but that's my platform is really about that, because I think we're just in a really critical place. We're at a crossroads kind of in our criminal justice system, with issues of police brutality and issues of poverty and issues of homelessness, issues of drug addiction, issues with, you know, bail, where, you know, people who can't afford bail are sitting in jail for longer times than the person who can, which makes, you know, bail punitive in some way, jail punitive before they've even been convicted.
Right.
We got to have that conversation. We got to talk about it, and we got to find ways to get the public and other organizations involved. Get us all at the table. Let's talk about it.
I think it'll make for some interesting community conversations for sure.
Oh yeah.
To learn kind of some of the back house ways of doing things as well. And I think again, part of it is we know it goes on, and you're not denying that either, but a lot of times you get hit over the head with the stories of failure. Mm-hmm. And so therefore everybody's lumped into that group. And I think also that acknowledging it is really part of the key. And I think it's gotten so polarized that you have a lot of the law enforcement community also in denial, because they know they don't do it and this and that, which is true, but they also know that other people within their group
do it.
So part of it is just, I think the first few that can step across the line and say, you know, I'll take responsibility for things that have been going awry, and I'm, you know, I'm making a commitment to keep the line straight from here, and, you know, you can watch me all you need to, and we're going to make a difference type thing.
And you know, and that's what leadership's really all about. You know, you take the lumps. You take the hits sometimes when things don't go right. And as a leader, you need to be able to say, hey, I have to be held accountable for what I'm doing as well.
Right.
So yeah, accountability is key.
Yeah, and you're going to be in charge of a lot of people. So when they make an error, it's still on you.
It's still on me. That's right.
And at some level, you see, there was a conversation the other day where we're talking about somebody that worked with a number of presidencies. And it didn't remember any time in which the president just came up and said, you know, my bad. That was really a bad move.
Yeah, I saw that Gates interview. Yes.
And that just to me is that's we need to start growing levels. And when you talk to somebody who really knows a lot about leadership, that's not how they speak. That's not what they would promote at all. And I think if you took them aside, a president would also say, well, that's not what a typical leader does. But that's where the political realm comes and takes over actions that you would make, which again is your motivation for what you're doing. Again, back to your point.
Yeah. And that's not real life. You know, in real life, right, you have to admit when you're wrong. And people appreciate that, I think, because they feel that you're being genuine and you're being real and you're being honest and transparent.
Right.
So when I'm wrong, just say I'm wrong. I think people appreciate that more than me trying to justify or excuse my behavior in some way.
I would hope that would stick, because that seems like certainly the honorable way to go about it. But the lack therein continues to be the way we're going.
Yeah.
Do you have anything that we didn't cover that you would like to pass on to anybody or our audience or anything?
Yeah. Register. Vote. I believe people should make informed voting decisions. They should educate themselves on the candidates. They should know who they're voting for, what they stand for, what their platforms are. You know, it's real easy to go out there and say, you know, I want reform and I want change, but what does that mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Some specifics.
Give me some specifics about what that is.
And we'll link your sites and different things like that so that people can go and learn about that kind of stuff. Is that typically the way you would do with any candidate? Would go to, they would create a website and then you'd go look at their website to learn their stances?
Go learn as much about them as you can. Mm-hmm. And I have on my website, I have I actually have a contact area. So that if you have a question for me and it's not answered in my website, you can ask me.
Oh, that's great.
And I'll respond. So just be educated voters. Make your vote count and register and vote.
Amen. I'm with you there too. And the educated voter is a key too.
That is a key. Because, you know, a lot of people go to the polls and they vote for, you know, the president and, you know, they vote for, you know, the governor, and then they go home. Yeah. And they go down the ballot and they look at, you know, the judges, and the DA races, and JPs and all of that. And they go, I don't know those people. Right. I'm not voting.
Right.
Well, get to know those people.
Yeah.
Learn about those people because those local races matter. And for a lot of people, the local races mean they matter more with their day-to-day living.
Right.
Than the president and the governor.
Right. So many people vote based on the impact that that person's going to have on their own lives anyway, which isn't necessarily the right motivation either.
Right.
But it's at least a starting point. You got to at least make a decision about whether it's about your community or it's about yourself or it's about the world. You got to educate yourself. So
that's right.
And that seems like an easy way to do it if they've got a website. At least if they're not full of malarkey.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can ask questions, I think that's great. So
Google.
Yes. Yeah. We'll link those things down to make it easy for people to look. But you've been a blessing. I really appreciate you. It's always good.
Thanks for having
good
me.
Seeing you
good
again.
Good seeing you too.
And then come back anytime. We'll talk about some of those release issues.
Yeah,
we'll get into a whole new thing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Keep on keeping on the golden age caffeine. It's some side wind you're on, another situation. See the road from the stripes with the lights coming on. Freedom came upon a catastrophic dream. Another dark page to turn, another situation. They can't have your heart to find. Trees can't see which way to turn, just take a new direction. See the road from the side, your old strides were ever long. Free to think about the way it's supposed to be. It's another dark page to turn, it's another situation.